Welcome back once again to season 4 of the podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. As many of you know, I wrote my autobiography as a survivor of human trafficking. It's called Custom Justice. But if you didn't know, you do now. Keeping in line with that, this entire season and last season has been focused on interviewing people who did or plan to write about their own experiences as trauma survivors and how they overcame the past. And as much as we all hate commercials, they are a necessary evil these days. This is what keeps the show on the air. You can also show your support by purchasing one of my mini books or donating through PayPal or leaving a review on whatever platform you listen to this podcast on. You can find the links for the books or donation options in the podcast description. As always, a portion of the proceeds go to local organizations that help fight human trafficking. Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. As always, I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. I have with me today an incredible young lady who lives by the mantra that anything is possible with God, grit, and grace. And man, does that resonate with me. Welcome to the show, Deb Curtis.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Amanda. It resonates with me too.
Well, I mean, with the kind of lives that people live, I think that a lot of people can probably identify with that, especially believers. Mm-hmm. And I love reaching out to believers, but I know that I have a huge audience of people who are not believers mm-hmm. yet, mm-hmm. but we might change that. You never know.
Right. You know, and even believers can stray away we have to find a way to reel ourselves back into him. We're all human and it happens.
Yep. I strayed for years.
Yeah. I've done my amount of stray too. I've asked for forgiveness. Thank goodness he forgives.
Absolutely. Deb, where are you originally from? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up as a baby, my first 3 years, born and raised on the south side of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And then my father back then, I think it might have been around 1970 or so, decided to do something totally off the cuff and move his family to this rural area south of Milwaukee, maybe about 45 minutes. You know, back then that seemed like forever, but today that's nothing for traveling. But back then everyone thought that he was nuts. And he raised us with my mom in a little home in a little town called Waterford, Wisconsin. So I'm a cheesehead. I love my Packers and I love my Bucks. We love our Brewers. And people say we're really hard fans. I think every team is hard on their teams, but Wisconsin can be a little bit hard, though, I would have to admit.
That's hilarious. I have a really good friend that grew up and went to college in Wisconsin, and he's kind of like you. He's got this beautiful sense of humor. He's got a wild story to tell, mm-hmm. and he says pretty much the same thing about sports fans.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wisconsin, you guys are a little bit tough on your team.
We are. And you know, it's crazy. Where I live now, we moved further south. So we're in this county that's on the border, the north border of Illinois. And half of our area here is Chicago fans. So Bears and Cubbies and then the other half is Wisconsin. So we truly have fun. Our subdivisions 50-50 and for a long time there, the Packers were doing well, but I think the tables have finally turned and we're going to see some greatness out of Chicago. So let's see what happens there.
Awesome. So tell me a little bit about the trauma that you had to go through that kind of put you on the life course that you've been on.
Yeah, you bet. And the trauma, it comes from personal and professional. And I guess what I'm realizing my theme is throughout life is looking for love in all the wrong places. And,
yeah.
You know, and it all started out back when, you know, we lived in that Milwaukee home on the south side. We were a family of five. I was the youngest of three. And then when we moved to this little town, in Waterford, a rural area, my mom took care of us kids. She was the, you know, full-time stay-at-home mom, and dad was working crazy hours. I just remember him working full-time, overtime. He worked in our basement. He was just working to try to make ends meet. I remember back then our mortgage, my dad, well, he talked about this in my older years, but the mortgage rate on our home back then, on the home that he made payments on, was at 18% because rates were that high back then. Oof. Yeah. Cost of living was crazy. I mean, we know we're in a pinch right now, but let's just say back then, I remember we would ration our milk. We would buy a gallon of milk and there'd be a big old box of the powdered milk. I think it was Carnation made it. It was like
Carnation instant milk. We had it too.
Yes. And we would make it half and half and even 3/4 powder and then mix the regular in. And we did that to survive because money was tight and rates were high and life was tough. But my mom, when we moved to this neighborhood, started to develop some friendships, and she was adopted. So she had she didn't have any family on her side. We were her family. Mm-hmm. She was given up as a baby and put on a fire station step. It was determined she had polio and she was going to, you know, have some issues. So her biological parents gave her up. She was from Chicago, and but she found my dad, and then she was blessed with our family. But things started to turn when we moved to the rural area, which is ironic because everyone thinks that the cities can be places where there is a lot of drugs and crime, but the rural areas have it just as much, but maybe more in a silent fashion. So she just got involved with the wrong people. And some of them were in that new subdivision that we moved into. So after drugs and Valium, I think she had messed around with the wrong people. And my dad tried to reunite the marriage and it just didn't work. And I was little then. I was only, I don't know, 8, 9 years old. And I remember my dad packing his bags in their master bedroom. And I asked him what he was doing. And he said he was moving out for good. And I grabbed a bag of Ruffles potato chips and I think a 2-liter of Coke and ran to the golf course and just ate and drank my soda and just thought about it for a while. Right then and there was my first, if you think about it, our daddies were our first love of man, right? Yeah. And my daddy loved me and I knew my mom didn't love him because she was really messed up mentally. She used to whip birds at him and in front of us kids and argue with him and just very bipolar. And I still remember her smoking cigarettes with those black dirty ashtrays in the house.
Oh, yep.
Mm-hmm. She'd be on the telephone with the long orange telephone cord all twisted and you know, smoke all over the house. You remember those days?
Oh yeah.
Good times.
Gross and nostalgic all at the same time.
Oh gosh. The colors. We had the yellow refrigerator. Oh my gosh. An orange telephone.
Ours was olive green.
Oh yeah. I remember the green carpeting was in.
Oh, the shag.
Shag. Good Lord. Oh, good Lord. Anyhow. So after he left, she had custody of me, the youngest. My oldest sister was gone. She went into the military. And then my other sister was home, but she was involved in drugs and alcohol. I mean, really bad. I remember many times her being sick in the house. And over time, my mom and her would host parties. And all of a sudden, before I knew it, this house that my dad moved us to from Milwaukee ended up being the party house in the little town and a drug house eventually where people were making deals. And I'm 9, 10 years old witnessing all of this. Ugh. Yeah. So thankfully, I knew better to still go to school and walk. I didn't have to take a bus. So school was all within walking distance. And over time, it got so bad that when my oldest sister would come back to visit from the military, she learned that I was abandoned. I was pretty much, I shouldn't say pretty much. I was threatened by my mom not to let my dad know, just to hide it all, because he would see me like twice a month. That was the orders. And then the authorities found out and the police came, and they immediately pulled me out of this drug infested house because I had to figure out how to feed myself. I had to figure out how to, it was just a messed up drug, dirty dog, pets, mess everywhere. I just, my dad got me out of there. And then back in the 70s, it was really difficult for the father to get full custody of the kids. It's just the judges always wanted the mom, no matter what, to have full custody. So it turned into a battle, Amanda. And my dad was losing. And this ended up being like an 18-month journey of him fighting custody for me. And it ended up being I had to stand up, because at that time I was pushing 12 years old because the case was taking that long. And the only way that my dad won custody of me was if I stood up and raised my right hand in court and testified against my mom on the left side with her attorneys and my dad on the right side with his attorneys. And he won custody because I spoke truth. I was finally allowed to say what was all going on, and it was hard. So she abandoned me from that point on for good, for good. And when I say for good, for 40 years of my life, I'm 55 years old, and I reunited with my mom in March of 2020 because of COVID. She was never part of my life prior to then. She missed my marriages. She missed my children. She just missed everything. And she called me up at 76 years of age, crying, scared about this pandemic in March of 2020, living in a drug house, a one-bedroom efficiency, not doing drugs anymore, but still smoking cigarettes and all that stuff. And she needed help. And so we moved her in with me. Can you believe that?
Oh my.
Yeah. And she still was bipolar and had a lot of issues. But here's the story, because I got to go back to part of my life, but I'm going to just want to end it on a good note with my mom. I learned to forgive. It wasn't easy when she lived with us. I almost lost my husband and my own family, my daughters, because they were just frustrated with how she was just acting, because she's very sick at 76 years of age. And I learned to forgive. And through all that, Amanda, was the lesson learned was that bitterness that was in me all those years was finally released. And now we moved her across town where we live today. She's about 8 minutes away from us, living in a nice senior apartment facility where there's a bunch of, you know, elderly people. It's very clean, real modern, and we get her groceries, take her to the doctors. She comes to visit us, and our relationship has mended. And people think I'm nuts, but I think it was a blessing in disguise. She keeps telling me that I'm a blessing to her, and really, in reality, I'm glad I had the opportunity to reunite with her, because I feel like when she's called home, I will be free. Otherwise, if we did not have this opportunity to forgive and mend, I don't know how I would feel the rest of my life. You know, you carry that burden on your heart. So I learned how to forgive. So then I want to just go through my first marriage. I was married to a husband who was a severe alcoholic. The usual story, domestic abuse. He was thrown in jail. I'm sure you've heard plenty of these stories over the years of hosting this wonderful show. And a lot of your audience members can resonate. But what was happening, what I learned to do from my childhood days with looking for love in all the wrong places, was hiding what was really going on in my life. Mm-hmm. And even though I was beat up and dragged and all that bad stuff in a very awful domestic abuse marriage, I still showed up in corporate America as a young adult, and put on a happy face and did the job more so than anyone else, and produced results, but nobody knew what was really going on behind the scenes. Then I started to dance with corporate America as a woman who didn't have a college education, because my dad When he had custody of me, he was paying alimony to my mom and trying to keep make ends meet with his work of what he was doing. He just said, I'm not putting you through college and I'm not signing for a student loan. And I'm like, okay. And everyone else that went to school with me, they're all going to universities. And I was bullied because I was the kid that wasn't going to school. But you know what I said, Amanda? I'm like, well, you know what? These aren't my friends. So I'm just going to show them and work really hard in corporate and climb up the ladder. And my very first job of 18 years, back then it was in the 1990s, I did the work. I did a good job, but they wouldn't promote me because I was a female. And I had to basically positively persistent manner tell them that you're making a big mistake. You know, I really want this job. I can prove to you that I can do it. So they promoted me. And they promoted me, but they didn't give me the same pay as the guys. But that's okay. I mean, I tried to get more of an increase. What mattered to me, Amanda, was having that promotion on my resume so it could take me other places throughout my corporate career climb. But I found out leaving and trying to interview at other places, I don't know what it was back then, but you had to have that university education. Yeah. It could have been I was studying something entirely different than finance, but you had to have that on your resume in order to even be considered for an interview. I don't know. Have you ever heard of that? But that's how it was.
Oh, yeah. I've run into that a lot myself. And I'm a high school dropout with no college education. It was a struggle trying to survive. Oh,
I'm so glad. I mean, not to hear that, but to hear that you understand this. I mean, And this is my message. It's like, your experience and my experience, I think, far outweighs a college education. You know, you can't teach what we went through in school.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, education is okay and it's nice to have, but lived practical experience is going to get you so much further in life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I'm going to rush the next 10, 20 years of my career basically was climbing the corporate ladder. Oh, by the way, I did divorce my first husband. He passed away when he was 40 years old from drinking. My husband today of 30 years adopted our oldest daughter, who was from my first husband.
Aww.
So it's a blessing in disguise because she is a sweetheart. My oldest daughter, and I love her to pieces. And I always told my ex-husband, because he had hidden hurts from his past, that if he ever got himself cleaned up, he absolutely could see my daughter, our daughter, again. And I always let her know about him as soon as she was old enough to understand. So so fast forward to all these last 20 years of corporate, trying to climb, Amanda, as a woman in a male-dominated industry, it was hard enough because I didn't have the college education. Even though the fire in the belly and the performance was on the resume, they would still pass on me. And then I could tell you stories of different stops working for several employers in a male-dominated industry, which is basically business financing, SBA loans. It's very driven by men from corporate America. I mean, that they're, who do you think sits in the banks for the majority and is taking care of small business loans? It's always pretty much a male commercial banker. But we're better today than where we were, let's just say that. So many stories of being passed over, many stories of toxic work cultures, many stories of looking for love in all the wrong places. And I felt like I had to constantly people please. And I don't do that. I'm like, I'm not people pleasing my way to a promotion. You had to be part of the quote unquote male boy club, right? You had to be part of that, right? And I wasn't going to have it. That wasn't me. So I left corporate America just recently. The chains are off my back and I can be a voice of reason for women, for people of color. I want unity and diversity and all people, all genders, all colors to have equality and fair lending practices and fair opportunity at being business owners. What I do is I help people acquire established small businesses through the SBA backed funding, bank financing. And the typical applicant, Amanda, historically, still today, is a white male corporate employee or a former white male corporate employee, which traditionally they've been the breadwinners. Traditionally, they've been promoted and they know how to navigate this area. And we need to do better as a country to teach women and other minority groups to have a fair and equal chance at these opportunities. And that's my passion today because I don't see it. I didn't see it when I was navigating the seas through corporate. I witnessed unfair and equal treatment of loan applicants, just assumptions because people have biases and they're not supposed to, but it happens. Yeah. So I'm that voice, Amanda. Those pains, those hurts personally and professionally over 40 years of my life have created who I am today. And I want to thank you first off for letting me speak so much because there was a lot to punch in there in a short amount of time. So I'll just pause and see if you got some other questions.
Well, I've got a few. I was jotting them down when I came up with them. You said that you were living alone when you were 10. Your mom had abandoned you. Your dad had already moved out. You're forced to live alone. What did you eat? How did you survive?
Yeah, I knew. Oh, man. Let's just say the refrigerator was full of mold. The food wasn't good. I learned how to be invited over for dinner at friends' homes in the subdivision. And I'm quite confident that they knew what was going on or that the mom wasn't present and they knew my dad, there was a divorce happening. The neighbors knew, but you're supposed to see something, say something. They didn't. But what they did was invite me over for dinner, like after school. I knew the only way that I'm going to survive is to be friends with everybody in this neighborhood to get an opportunity to eat something. And that's how I did it. And then my friends knew when they came over, the house was just a shambles and they knew my mom wasn't there. So they were real helpful too, but they didn't tell their parents either. It is true. Do you think that still resonates today that people see something and they still don't say something?
Oh, absolutely. We see it all the time. You know, when somebody's being assaulted somewhere like a train station or on the streets of a busy sidewalk, people would rather pull out their phones and take videos and photos than step in and actually do anything to help. Mm-hmm. And it's always been the way. I mean, I think that it's wonderful that people like you are out here wanting to change this mindset. But they see something, say something. Actually started out as, I think it was a Subway slogan in New York City. And it's been adopted now for all over the country. It started out as see something, say something when it comes to assault on the subway. Mm-hmm. Or I think it was maybe jumping the rails at the subway. Something silly, something small. Mm-hmm. It's now been the adopted slogan for most of the anti-trafficking organizations in the U.S. It is something that I was taught when I was a flight attendant. It's taking off and it's helping, but there's still too many people out there that say, I'm not going to get involved. Or there's people who say, if I lift a hand to help that person, I can get sued because this happens. Mm-hmm. And it's sad.
It is sad. And I think back to some of my corporate employers where there was a male toxic supervisor and all the women on the team, they knew he was destructive to women, but they wouldn't say anything for fear of retaliation. So that I call that the corporate culture of silence. People are afraid to say something.
You know, I hate to admit to it, but I was in that exact situation as recently as 2019.
Yeah. I know. I mean, I don't know your situation, but I'm with you. Yeah. And I'm so glad you're speaking up to that, because women need to know they're not alone. Cause I always thought, is this just me?
Right.
And it's not, but the scary thing is, and I'm actually speaking up on this, there's human resource departments, and I have learned through my, yes, you know where I'm going with this. They shouldn't be called human resource departments. They should be called
their company resources.
Yes. Corporate leadership protection department is what it should be called. Don't even go that route. It's you're just asking for your ticket to be pushed out is what it is. So that see something, say something. It was not practiced in the 70s, and here we are, 2023, and we still have work to do.
Absolutely. So much work. Yeah. 2019, to make note of your human resources comment. I have to agree. I was being followed home by another employee. I was being threatened and constantly harassed. I had lies being told about me. And this was all within my first month on the job. Mm-hmm. When I told human resources what was happening, they said, do you need me to do anything? That should not be a response.
Yeah. Wow.
And then fast forward 3 years later, they overheard a conversation. I was on the phone with my lawyer about my human trafficking case. They found out I was a survivor of human trafficking, called me into the human resources office and fired me.
Oh my gosh.
After 3 years on the job.
Because of overhearing that conversation.
Yeah. And it was a boys club. It was absolutely a boys club.
Yeah.
The only woman who was a part of the boys club was the head of human resources.
Yeah. Oh, it's all too familiar to me.
Yeah.
Too familiar.
Did your mom ever apologize to you now that you've been able to kind of have a communication relationship with her?
Not direct, because so much happened. Her way of apologizing to me has been, I don't deserve this. And I tell her, you know, God's not finished with you yet, you know, so yes, you do deserve it. And that's why you're here experiencing it.
Yeah. You know?
So, and she'll say to me, what a blessing I have been after all that I had been through. And that, you know, she doesn't deserve it, but she's never really said, I'm sorry. But, and, you know, it was hard because that was some serious, that was an 18 month trial. And, tell me this, I mean, the trauma that you have gone through, because this is my experience, and I think it must be stemmed by me being told not to say something, that I tend to forget it, or if it's that fear that just pushes it down so far, it's hard to remember some of the stuff that really did happen until you start talking about it. Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I started trying to figure out how I was going to write my book many, many years before I actually wrote it. Mm-hmm. And doing that, I started to come up with like little glimpses of memories. It's like, oh, I remember this weird time. I remember this one time that this other thing happened. And they started to connect together in a strange way. Mm-hmm. When I sat down to write my book, it was December of 2020. And I wrote the entire 350-page book in the single month. Everything came out of me, including things that I had not thought of or remembered in decades. Mm-hmm. All of this stuff came pouring out. And it's similar to what's known as EMDR therapy. It's an association therapy where you start thinking about things based on, during this one incident that happened last year, I felt this way. It reminded me of the time that I felt this way that was related to this other event. And you start thinking about that other event and your brain kind of spirals down this track. Mm-hmm. And it's bizarre the way that you can kind of make these connections and understand where your trauma responses come from and why you react to what seems to be innocuous situations in a non-innocuous kind of way.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That makes sense. It's something else. And being a guest on podcasts, it's almost a way for me to heal. But yes, at the same token, it's like, oh, more stuff is coming out of me that it's like, oh, I forgot about that, you know? And the pretend, you know, you pretend everything is okay. And then all of a sudden it's like, no, that wasn't okay. It was not okay.
Right.
Wow.
And you had commented earlier on one of my LinkedIn posts about, the post was about being low maintenance in relationships is not a badge of honor. Mm-hmm. You said that one hit you really hard. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that it would, if I posted maybe more often on LinkedIn, it might actually get seen more. But yeah, we grow up learning to hide our feelings because we're told that they don't exist. We're told, oh, if you think this is bad, you should see what I had when I was your age. You know, we're taught these constant lessons of repressing ourselves, mm-hmm, to the point we no longer feel like we have a voice that should be heard at all. Yeah. It's exactly the opposite. And when you start getting heard, that's, mm-hmm, when all that stuff starts coming out because you have pushed it down for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think of the time sitting in the conference room with all men with our, you know, loan committee approval meetings, and I'm the only woman. I didn't even want to blink my eyes. I used to squeeze my butt cheeks to try to not cry. Like in my chair, I'd squeeze my butt as hard as I could to not cry. Because just the way that they would talk to me, it was just crazy, Amanda, crazy. And you had to stifle it and not, and show that you're strong, like they are, so to speak. And so I say, let it go now. That's what I'm doing. That's why when I saw your post, it's just like, whoa, this is huge. Low maintenance is not good because you're holding everything in. We don't need to hold everything in.
Right. Exactly. You need to take up your space.
Thank you. And when I'm starting to see this, and women need leaders like you that have a voice with a show like this to help them find a way to get out of what they're in. If, you know, we didn't have this. The way I figured it out was I pulled a book. Somebody recommended a book called Codependency No More, by Melody Beatty, I think her name is. And that changed my life. You know, it's basically people pleasing to make sure everybody's happy. Everybody at the corporate job, my mom's happy, my dad's happy, everybody's happy, but you're the one that's not.
Right. And so many people don't realize that people pleasing is a trauma response, but it totally is. Mm-hmm. You know, when you put it into terms of critical thinking, it makes absolute sense. If you're put into a dangerous or abusive situation for a prolonged period of time, like your entire childhood, it becomes second nature for you to try to make those around you happy just, mm-hmm, to avoid them getting angry so, yeah, that they can abuse you more. This, yeah, becomes kind of a learned behavior. It builds new neurosynapses in our brains. And, mm-hmm, every time we repeat these behaviors, we are reinforcing this habit and telling ourselves that this is the correct thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to feel loved, you know, you don't want to feel hurt.
Right.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yes. The corporate knows. And I would just walk out of conference rooms, you know, for promotion, and the corporate knows, or the corporate disciplines for things that weren't even reasonable. You drive in your car away. It's like, why me? Where did that come from? yeah. Wow. Be a voice. That's what I'm going to say, Amanda. Keep this show pounding. Any of you out there listening, if you have a story, you got to connect with Amanda and get it out. Don't wait 30, 40 years like me. That would be my message, because that's too long. That's too long. And back in the day, seeking help for mental health, seeking help for not feeling right, you didn't talk about it because you had fear you wouldn't get a job if they found out, oh, Deb's got a mental problem, right?
Yeah. Or you'd get ostracized.
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to a shrink? You must be crazy.
Yeah. Or you won't qualify for life insurance. I remember my husband when we were first married, after my first child, I just was having issues after birth that the hormones weren't coming back. And I wanted to see a doctor. He's like, you can't do that. You'll never get life insurance again. I'm like, what? What? He goes, that'll be on your record and corporate will never hire you. And we believe that. That's what we believe. Now, was it true or not? I don't know, but anything's possible.
I mean, knowing what we know now about the practices of mental health, I don't think it would have been legal for them to share that information from a therapist or psychologist to an employer, unless it was somebody who was hired by the company.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But there's a lot of those myths and rumors that are still perpetuated to this date. If you go into a doctor's office and you put that you're depressed down on paperwork, you can never own a gun.
Right. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's just the most bizarre thing that we still have these rumors and these blatant falsehoods that we're still buying into around mental health. Mental health is every bit as important as physical health.
That's right. It is. And I would say this is a strong belief of mine that for many of us, corporate experiences are part of mental health issues, especially post-traumatic, like being let go or being dismissed, you know, that where is the responsibility? I don't know. I guess there is none because it's all at will, right? Everything is at will. So that's the key right there. You're employed at will and they can let you go today for you got the wrong color shirt on. And
that, or for being a survivor of human trafficking over a decade before.
That's nuts. Just
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it still happens so regularly.
What do you think about corporate? This used to bother the bananas out of me. silly freaking monkey surveys or surveys. This is confidential and they're trying to get a test of what's the culture. All right, you know, when there's like a bad supervisor, that one bank I work for where the president just ripped on women and just anger and swearing. You know, and then he's gone and everyone's talking. Are you going to say the truth? And everyone's like, heck no. They say it's confidential. That ain't confidential. He's looking right at it. So how do you get answers out of a survey? I mean, come on. What are your thoughts on that?
I think electronic surveys are always going to breed distrust. Mm-hmm. If they want people to answer honestly, the best way to do that is to have them type up something so you can't read the handwriting. Fold up your printed out piece of paper and put it in a private box.
Yeah.
That's the only way that you're ever going to get employees to tell the truth. It has to be anonymous and it has to be proven to be anonymous.
Something so simple and they won't do that, Amanda.
I know. And it definitely wouldn't have happened in the job that I was ceremoniously fired from in 2019. It was a small office, but we had hundreds of employees. Most of them worked out in the field.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to ask all of them, how do you feel about so-and-so in the office over there? Because they don't know so-and-so in the office over there.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It was awkward. So tell me about how has God shown up in your life through all of this?
I asked in my younger days when the family was broken, believe it or not, at 9 years old, when I ran away with that bag of potato chips and the 2 liter of Coke, I just prayed that our family would be normal and that I wanted a normal family. I didn't really know, like, is there a God? But my mom did take us to Catholic Sunday services and she would go early to make sure we sat in the front pew. And if we didn't get the front pew, it was going to be a bad Sunday. Let's just say that. She was real strict. And I didn't get much out of the Catholic religion at 9 years old. None of that meant anything to me, but I knew there was a higher power that was being talked about. So I remember then praying for, I just want a normal family, Amanda. I remember just praying that. And then the first marriage, falling apart and being a complete nightmare. I can still remember crying my eyes out, sitting on my bed. And at that point, I knew there was a God. And I had this belief that you can't break up a marriage because it's, you know, it's in the Bible. You got to stick together, you know, through goodness and through health and bad and everything. And I'm like, Lord, tell me. I mean, this is bad. I mean, and I talked to some ministers at the time, and they're like, oh no, if he's hurting you, if he's trying to kill you, you have the right to leave that marriage. Right. So after three attempts of leaving, my dad rescued me a second time with my big old Uncle Joe and police with a restraining order the third time, and got me out of the apartment that we were living in. And I still was praying for a normal family. So here I am at that point. I was approaching my late 20s, and I met a fella that worked at the same company that I did for that first 18 years. And he was previously married. We knew each other probably for 10 years. I knew him through his marriage. He knew me through mine. He got divorced, and we were always good friends. We used to compete against each other on the same team at work. And I swore I would never date anybody that I worked with, but he was persistent and asked me several times. And I finally caved in. And the only way, Amanda, that he would consider dating me was if I was a believer. I had faith and a relationship with Christ. And wow. I did. We had conversations on the phone, and we did in person. And we were going to a very well-known Christian church. And then we started seeking marriage counselors because we were engaged pretty darn quick. My dad was scared for my future. He's like, you're rebounding too fast. I'm like, no, I think this is the one. You know, you can't blame him after what he saw I had been through. But then our pastors are like, okay, either you get married now because you can't live together, you're living in sin, or you separate and plan your wedding, and then you're back together again. So we got married right away. We got married within like 90 days, and it's going to be 30 years later.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And prayers were answered because I have three beautiful daughters, the oldest from my first husband. And my husband today adopted her when she was 4 years old. And I have now, I'm a new grandma. I have four grandbabies. And
oh my gosh.
Those are my two oldest daughters. They married their high school sweethearts, and they're both expecting each their third in November of this year. And we still have our 16-year-old youngest daughter living at home with us. So God is really showering me with family now, called children and grandchildren, and a blessing with a wonderful, faithful husband. Our faith is strong. So to all of your listeners out there, don't give up, because he does. He will answer prayers in his way and in his timing. And it might be a while, so just believe and hang in there.
Well, congratulations on being a grandmommy. My son and his wife just had a baby last year in the spring.
Okay.
And my husband's daughter just had a baby last month.
Oh yeah. It's crazy. They're having lots of kids these days. Is it just me?
Oh, I'm just excited. You know what? I have to thank the pandemic. Pandemic helped out at least a little bit with this. People were forced to stay inside and have communications with the people in their world.
I tell everyone, these are my COVID babies. They are. I mean, but I'm like, okay, now, okay, that's enough. We can stop.
Give it a little space. You don't need them back to back right now.
It's a joy. And my mom, she gets to be a part of those grandbabies too. Aww. So, and my daughters, they knew what it was like not to have her around. So they were bitter for a long time without her being around, but they forgave her, and they love her. And So isn't that kind of, that's really nice how that all came. I lost my dad about 5 years ago unexpectedly. Mm. He was my hero.
Oh,
he saved me, you know, from the abandonment. He saved me from the first marriage. And we went fishing all the time in Wisconsin. I have a crappie, a bluegill, and a smallmouth bass mounted that I caught with my dad. So those are some great memories.
Oh, that's so cool. You actually have trophies.
Yes, I do. I'm proud of those. Yeah. Good, wow. Good times. Good fish in Wisconsin if you ever want to come fishing.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I haven't been fishing since I was probably at about 18 years old.
Yeah, it's been great. I miss it. I haven't gone myself in a while. My dad, he loved to fish every day. He and he cooked really good bluegills too. Oh my goodness, they're good. Yeah.
So would you consider yourself to be an introvert or an extrovert? And have you always been that way, or did you think that changed?
Yeah. Everybody perceives me as an extrovert. And for the majority of my life, I always said I was an extrovert. And I realized through my healing as I'm older now, that extrovert was the pretend person that everything is okay. In reality, Amanda, I know I'm an introvert. I love to be home when it's quiet. These days, I'm more of an introvert just to be safe and to stay home. Everyone says they think of me as an extrovert. I tell them, no, I'm an introvert that pretends to be an extrovert. Because that's how I grew up, people pleasing and trying to find love. Does that make sense?
Shopping the neighbor's houses for food.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So
I grew up for a little while as an extrovert and started very quickly changing into an introvert. I was an A-type personality when I was a kid, and I'm way more relaxed now. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to face that for a long, long time. When I was a flight attendant, I kept on telling everybody, no, I'm totally an extrovert. At the end of the day, I was so exhausted. All I wanted to do was go home and pretend like people didn't exist.
Yeah.
And I learned.
Yeah.
And we do change because of what we've been through. And sometimes that's one of the biggest personality changes I've noticed.
So how long were you a flight attendant for?
2 years, 3 months, 28 days. Not that I was counting.
I give all of them so much kudos. God bless them, especially these days. Oh,
wow. That was a wild existence. That was 2013 to 2015.
Okay. Yeah. And I remember being a little girl dreaming to be a flight attendant. Oh my God.
Yeah, it was so strange. I never dreamed of it. Okay. I never wanted to do it. I went to an interview because I had a character that I was trying to write and a short story that I was putting together.
Okay.
And that character didn't show up the interviews and they hired me.
Wow. Look at that. Twists and turns along the way.
Oh, yeah. So I became the character that I was writing about. That's very amazing. Weird the way that happened.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you were a flight attendant pre-COVID. That's good.
Yes. Yeah, I can't even imagine now.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Wow. Oh, what a story. What a story. Yeah, I don't like flying anymore. It's just, I prefer to just stay home. There's plenty to see here in little Wisconsin.
Yeah. I do public speaking sometimes out of state. And in April, at the end of April, I was doing a talk down in a church in a small town in Arizona.
Okay.
And my husband and I, rather than flying, we opted to drive, and we jumped in his Corvette and dropped the top and went. And
good it was for a blast. You. Now that sounds like fun, in a Corvette with the top down.
Oh my gosh. That was a lot of fun.
That is a blast. I would have done the same thing if I were you, although we don't have the Corvette. So maybe we'll rent one and do it, my husband and I.
Oh my gosh, yes. Or a Miata. I've had Miatas off and on for years, and that car is so much fun.
That's cool.
So zippy. That's cool. Yeah. Deb, there's always one last question that I ask people before I let them go.
Yeah.
And it's my favorite question, and I get so many different answers. What is one thing that you really love about yourself that's not related to your physical appearance?
I would answer, I am a sensitive person. And I used to look at that as negative, but today I look at it as a superpower. Being sensitive truly defines that you're an authentic, honest, vulnerable person. You can't be sensitive when you're faking it, unless you're a really good actress. But for the most part, being sensitive is truth, and that's a superpower. And I believe people want to know you more when you can open up like a book and share your story. And finally in my life, Amanda, I'm here to open my book and share my story. I don't have to hide anymore. And that's my superpower. And it feels good.
It's absolutely beautiful. And your website, debcurtis.com, that's debcurtis.com. That's how people would be able to reach out to you to talk about small business ownership and to talk to you about your story and to maybe have getting you on their shows or their podcast.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Of course. Any last words of wisdom that you would like to leave for anybody?
Yes. May we all open up our tables, whether it's in our home, in our business, at work, and practice unity in diversity. That's my message as we end the show.
And don't forget to feed those kids.
There you go. Thank you. Amen to that. Or I'm going to the neighbors.
If you've enjoyed tonight's episode, please make sure you check out the episode description. There you'll find links on how you can learn more about this guest, links to connect with them on social media, and how to support the podcast. Remember, I don't get paid to do this. My boss is a bit tight-fisted. I can say that. I work for myself. In short, this show really is all about the guest. If you've enjoyed their interview, please feel free to let them know. You can also tune in to my other podcast, Growth from Darkness, which is co-hosted by a lovely lady from Australia. We talk about what trauma responses are and healthy ways to move beyond the past. For more information, just go to growthfromdarkness.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/growthfromdarkness.